Bible reading this morning is from Mark chapter 10. We're looking at verses 32 to 52. If you'd like to follow along with the Bibles that are in the pew, it's page 1002. So, Jesus again predicts his death. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit on your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road.
Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Eric, and it's great to be at church with you. It's going to be a great day, actually. Beautiful weather. What a great day for the men to play bowls this afternoon. What a great morning, great afternoon, great day to be at church. I might begin with a little joke. There was a preacher and his wife. They were having discussions, regular discussions, about how she'd been spending her money, or his money. She'd recently returned home with a fabulous new dress. And as she was trying it on, the husband said, "Wow, you do look amazing. But isn't that just a little bit too expensive for our budget right now?" And she said, no, you've got to understand how it all happened. "I was walking by the window and I saw this beautiful dress. And it kind of called out to me and dragged me into the shop. And before I knew it, I was wearing it, trying it on. It was as if the devil was saying to me, 'You look great in that dress.'" The husband said, "Come on, why couldn't you be a bit more like Jesus and say, 'Get behind me, Satan'?" "I did," she said, "but he said it looked great from there too." Last week, we arrived at the turning point of Mark's gospel. Up until chapter 8, the big, big, big question that's facing everyone when you read the gospel, the first chapter, eight chapters, is who is Jesus? Who is this man? Because event after event, we see Jesus' power, we see his authority, we see his divinity, we see his just amazingness of what all the things he's doing. He raises the dead. He casts out demons. He heals the sick. He gives sight back to the blind. And finally, in Mark chapter 8, verse 29, when Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do you say I am?" Peter declares that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus is the Messiah. And straight after Peter's declaration, Jesus immediately explains what it means to be the Christ in the most morbid and unexpected way. Jesus says that he's going to suffer. He's going to die. And after 3 days, he's going to rise from the dead. To that, he's rebuked by Peter. And Jesus famously retorts, "Get behind me, Satan." In fact, in these chapters, chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10, Jesus explains what it means to be the Christ in 3 identically morbid and unexpected predictions. In chapter 8, verse 31, in chapter 9, verse 30, in chapter 10, verse 32, which is today's passage, what's going on is that in these 3 chapters, Mark is explaining for us, setting before us, what does it mean for Jesus to be the Christ? What does it mean for Jesus to be the Messiah? And so if you have your Bibles open to Mark chapter 10, that'd be fabulous. And this passage this morning tells us 3 things about what it means for Jesus to be the Christ. The first thing is this. The first thing it means for Jesus to be the Christ is that he fulfills the role of the suffering servant. Today we'll concentrate particularly on the last prediction, as I said before, and it's really quite detailed. Jesus says, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Now, this is quite unexpected for the apostles. They were thinking that for Jesus to be the Christ, it would mean something completely different. We heard last week that in chapter 8, verse 32, Peter rebuked Jesus. How could Jesus say such things like this? For hundreds and hundreds of years, Israel's been waiting for their Messiah to come. They expected the Messiah figure would be a superhero who would fight Israel's enemies and win, who would restore the temple, who would reestablish Israel as the great nation, as in the glory days of Kings David and Solomon. The idea of suffering, the idea of being killed, what's Jesus talking about? Shouldn't he be preparing for battle? Jesus the Messiah? He's God's king. God's on his side. When we read the Old Testament, well, all the guys who seem to have God on their side always win, no matter what the odds. Think of Moses or Daniel or Elijah or David or Samson. If God's on his side, how could Jesus even talk about losing, let alone being handed over and being killed by his enemies? But Jesus had a very different idea of what it means for him to be the Messiah. He tells the disciples on those 3 occasions, those 3 times, that he will suffer, be killed, and then rise again after 3 days. What Jesus actually is doing is he is telling us that he is fulfilling the role of the suffering servant that we read about in Isaiah chapter 53. I'll flash it up on the screen for you. Isaiah 53 says this: "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried them our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted." So when Jesus talks about being the Christ, he's also talking about being the suffering servant. That's why in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, in today's passage, Jesus says, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many." Now, Jesus makes his purpose of coming very clear. It's not an incidental thing that Jesus would suffer and die. It's not as if he was in the wrong time and the wrong place. It's not as if he suffered and died because he wasn't strong enough or powerful enough to stop his death coming. He didn't die just to set up an example of what it means to love our enemies either. No, he predicted his suffering and death with alarming accuracy because Jesus knew exactly why he came and he knew exactly what he came to do. Many of you know that 2 weeks ago I came back from India, and my travelling companion in India was another minister, Craig, from Neutral Bay. On the way home, we were separated. I was on a different flight to him. So whilst I was already on the plane, Craig was waiting to get into the airport. And what you've got to understand is in India, airport security is extremely tight. As you hop out of the taxi or whatever, or the bus, whatever, however you came, you get checked by armed guards, soldiers. And then your bags get checked, and then you form a line. At the front of the line, four armed guards, four armed soldiers, scary guys like that. They check your passport, then they check your flight itinerary, then they check the flight manifest to see if you're even on the flight. And if you don't meet any of those criteria, you don't even get into the airport building in order to check in. Unfortunately, because we had our flights changed, Craig wasn't on the flight manifest. So as he was standing there, kind of arguing with these armed guards in broken English, he developed a gurgle in his stomach. And that gurgle in his stomach was an extreme acute case of Deli Belly hitting him right there and then. He was so overwhelmed with the feeling of what had to happen next. He thought, I've got to make a dash. I'm going to miss the plane, or I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't care. I've got to run to the toilet. This is what he did. He actually shoulder charged the four armed men and he sprinted for his life to the toilet. He lived to tell the tale, by the way. And as I was catching up with him, I asked him, what on earth were you thinking? He said, I knew that the only thing I had to do right then and there was get to the toilet. It didn't matter if I got shot in the back or not. I was going to make a mess either way. He knew exactly what he came to do. He knew exactly what he had to do, and he did it. Jesus came to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And a ransom is a price that one pays to liberate a slave. And the liberation that Jesus is talking about, what's he talking about? We've already seen throughout Mark that he's freed many from demons, disease, and even death, all by a mere word or by someone touching his cloak. He's liberated many from the fear of their outcast status by the way he treated them with acceptance and reassurance. But what's Jesus talking about here, about freeing, paying a ransom, liberating? What on earth is it talking about? Well, from Isaiah 53 again, if you go the next verse down, it's liberation from our sins and sin's effects. I'm going to read verse 5 of Isaiah 53. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressions. So Jesus, he liberates us from sin and its effects. And the obvious question is, the next question you've got to ask is, why did Jesus have to die to liberate us from our transgressions, to liberate us from our iniquities? In the Old Testament, we see that God requires blood as an innocent animal, of an innocent animal as a sacrifice for the sins of the people. But surely, isn't God's requirement of a blood sacrifice kind of arbitrary? Why can't God just accept our faults, our transgressions, our misdoings, and sweep them under the carpet and forgive and forget and move on? Why does blood need to be spilt? Why does anything need to die, let alone Jesus? It's a good question. But as we answer that question, we've got to understand the seriousness of sin. When we sin, that's when we do anything that is not right according to God's standards. We're setting ourselves up as rival judges of what's right and wrong. We're setting ourselves up as little God and rejecting God. When we sin, we're like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden when they decided not to listen to God's instruction and set their own standards. And God sets the punishment for human rebellion, and the punishment is death. Now, if you think about it objectively, take away the emotion, take away the subjectivity, it kind of makes sense. It kind of seems fair. If God is the creator of all creation, and creation goes rotten, then I suppose he's got whatever right to do whatever he wants to it. I've said it before, and I'll say it again, I find MasterChef really boring. Really boring. Doesn't matter if it's the little kids, the cute ones, or the kind of the annoying adult MasterChefs, or the prima donna professional MasterChefs. Whatever it is, it's boring to me. Food doesn't make me cry. Thinking, cooking a meal is not a journey for me. It's just food. Anyway, let's imagine for a moment that I cooked a meat pie for lunch today. Let's just imagine that on the meat pie sitting there ready for the family, it looks beautiful, ready to be eaten, but we get a last minute call, we're going out for lunch, do you want to come? Yeah, okay, we'll go. I'll leave the meat pie there. A blowfly comes in sometime in the afternoon, lays a little egg. Maybe by the next morning, I haven't done anything to it, and it's got a few little maggots crawling around in it. Maybe I'll leave it for a few days and it's fly-blown, half-eaten, things crawling out and spreading across the kitchen table. Now, when I come back eventually, after 3 days, I'm going to clean out the kitchen. When I come back, I'm not thinking, oh, well, that meat pie, it's so valuable to me, I need to fix it and eat it. I'm not thinking, oh, those maggots there, what about their feelings when I throw out, when I get rid of this? I'm thinking, I own that pie. It is my pie. I do what I like to it. It's rotten. I'm going to throw it straight in the bin. That's what it's like when all creation goes rotten and sins before God. God has every right to toss it out. However, the astonishing thing is that God didn't give up on his rebellious creatures. He has mercy and compassion on us. He gave his people a way out. And in the Old Testament, it was the sacrificial system. The sacrificial system, the spilling of the blood of goats. We know that the sacrificial system in the Old Testament kind of didn't work out. And so it proved that we needed something more. So God sent his son, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, to save us, to truly liberate us from our sins. It requires someone who is not in the same predicament as us to take the punishment. And this is where Jesus comes in. He's strong and powerful, the rightful Christ. And unlike us, he is always good. Good in the sense of always doing what is right before God. And so his death, his blood is the ransom price it takes to pay to liberate us. Our physical, social, emotional, psychological problems, yeah, they're problems. But they are dwarfed by the grave spiritual problem we all face by being out of relationship with God, by being sinful, rebellious, rotten creatures deserving of death before God. So Jesus had to die to liberate us from all of this. And that is what he came to do. So for Jesus to be the Christ, he has come to be the suffering servant and who would give his life to free us. Now in Victorian England, so we're talking 17th, 18th, 19th century England, treadmills weren't found in air-conditioned gyms. They were found in prisons, jails they were found in. Treadmills were used in penal servitude as a form of punishment. Now, some of those treadmills were productive. They were used for grinding wheat or transporting water. So all day, these prisoners would walk that treadmill, which is basically a big wheel. Some were used for productive means. Others were just punitive, in the sense that they just walked a wheel for no reason the whole day. The hope the prisoner had was that at some day in the future, he would have paid his debt to society. He would have paid his ransom so that he could be free. Remember that Christ has set you free so that you're no longer chained and sentenced to be on that treadmill of sin and failure. He's paid the ransom. He's paid the price that was demanded for your sin and rebellion so that you can be released from sin. The second thing it means for Jesus to be the Christ is that he is the Son of Man. Now, the title Son of Man is a very interesting title. It's what Jesus calls himself in each of those three predictions about his suffering, death, and then rising again. He calls himself Son of Man three times there. Now, there are two reasons why Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. The first is because Son of Man is a relatively unknown title. So it's not loaded with all the expectations and of calling himself the Messiah or Christ. But importantly, I think also Jesus calls himself the Son of Man because he has Daniel chapter 7 in mind. In the Old Testament book of Daniel, Daniel had a vision of four beasts representing four different kingdoms. And these beasts, one after another, are stripped of their authority until one like a Son of Man came in the clouds and he approached God and was given all authority, glory, and power. And all peoples would bow down and worship him, and his kingdom would be everlasting. Now, if you compare this idea of Son of Man, the Daniel idea of Son of Man being some glorious, powerful, all-conquering figure, you compare that figure of that understanding of what it means to be the Christ to the suffering servant understanding of being a Christ, the one who's beaten, handed over, humiliated, and dies. How does it all fit together? If on one side to be the Christ is to be glorious, on the other side is to be humiliated, how does it all work? Well, let's look again. The apostles didn't quite get it either. When you look at verse 35 onwards of chapter 10, let's read. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory. Now you've got to remember that Jesus had just predicted that he would suffer and die. Now listen to what Jesus says in verse 42. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Now the Gentiles were anyone who are not of Jewish origin. That's pretty much most of us here. The Gentile rulers lorded over the people. And in our world, it's kind of the same. In our world, leadership's about power, authority, glory, and dominion. You just follow through the news the last couple of weeks. You follow through what's happening to Eddie Obeid and his trail of corruption. You follow through what's happening with the implosion of the Labor Party and federal government. But the Son of Man, his kingship is radically opposite. Instead of being served by all, Jesus is the greatest servant of all. The Isaiah suffering servant who would be despised, spat at, flogged, executed, all for the sake of other people. He gave up all his rights, all he had, and even gave up his life for others. The way that Jesus rules is by serving. The way that Jesus rules is by humbling himself before others and considering others' needs before his own. His glory is shown on the cross. The rulers of the nations, the beasts of Daniel's vision, they rule by their hunger of power, exalting their own greatness and trampling on other people. The irony is that Jesus would be killed under the authority of these Gentiles. But ultimately, the Son of Man is handed all authority and glory and power, and all the nations would bow down before him, and all his kingdom will never end. And the unexpected God proves this by raising Jesus from the dead 3 days later. So the Daniel, son of man, the glorious one, and the Isaiah, humiliated, suffering servant, they are one in the Christ. Because the suffering servant is exalted in his death and resurrection. This is what it means for Jesus to be the Christ. The third thing that it means for Jesus to be the Christ is that we must follow Jesus' lead. Look again at verse 42 to 44. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Our natural inclinations is to be like James and John. Leadership, as the world tells us, seeks power so that others will serve us for our sake, for our comfort, for our self-fulfillment. Today, leadership's about me. I do the bits I like, the things that suit me, and the lowly, dirty, annoying things, leave that to other people below me. That's kind of how the world leads and tells us to lead. That's not the way of Jesus. Jesus teaches us that true leadership is about servanthood. We're to do all things for the sake of other people. We're to relinquish our rights so that others may grow. Leadership is about other people. We do what no one wants to do. We do the dirty work. We do the work where we have to go out of our way to help others. So leadership following in Jesus' model is costly and inefficient and inconvenient. But time and time again, Jesus' way is the smartest way, the most effective way. Jesus leads the way into his suffering, death, and glory. And he asks us, his followers to follow his lead. And you've got to ask yourself this morning, what kind of leader are you? Will you serve as Jesus serves? Are you willing to suffer as Jesus suffered? Do you see what it means for Jesus to be the Christ? Do you see what it means to follow Jesus' lead? The passage finishes off with a blind man called Bartimaeus. He calls out to Jesus, and from verse 49, Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped up on his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," Jesus said, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the way. The Bartimaeus healing is the perfect paradigm for all of us. Though he was physically blind, he actually saw who Jesus was. He actually saw what does it mean for Jesus to be the Messiah, the Christ. So throwing off all he owned, he trusted Jesus and followed Jesus along the way. Because in the end, what Mark wants to tell us is that discipleship, the concept and idea of what discipleship is actually quite easy. Even a lowly, pathetic, blind beggar gets it. We're to trust Jesus and follow him along the way. And when we trust Jesus and follow him along the way, it will involve suffering. It will involve giving up everything for the sake of others. But what we gain is immensely more valuable. True sight, true healing, liberation from our sins, a place in the unexpected God's eternal kingdom.